Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're streaming live at KUCI.org. Today is Wednesday, April 17th, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is Benjamin Dreyer, author of the new book, Dreyer's English, An Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style. Benjamin is vice president, executive managing editor, and copy chief of Random House. He began his publishing career as a freelance proofreader and copy editor. In 1993, he became a production editor at Random House, overseeing books by writers including Michael Chabon, Edmund Morris, Suzanne Laurie Parks, Michael Pollan, Peter Straub, and Calvin Trillin. He's copy edited books by authors including E.L. Doctorow, David Ebershoff, Frank Rich, and Elizabeth Strout, as well as Let Me Tell You, a volume of previously unpublished or uncollected work by Shirley Jackson. He's a graduate of Northwestern University. He lives in New York City, and he's with us right now. Hi, Benjamin.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Great to have you on the show. I'm so excited.
Me too.
Let's start by you telling us how this book came about, Dreyer's English.
Well, I had in my 20s, I had done a little bit of writing here and there. I thought I might like to be a writer, and I did some nonfiction work reviewing for a local paper in Chicago that went well, but I had aspirations to write fiction, and it all went so badly for me. It was the wrong time of my life to be writing, which is to say I was anxious and terrified and blocked. And I kept trying, and it kept pushing back at me. And I remember a friend of mine saying to me once, it's a terrible thing to always be in a state of not writing. So I set it aside, and I did other things. And eventually I wandered into my proofreading and copy editing career and found that hugely satisfying, creatively satisfying, spiritually satisfying. I think I'd like to point out, and I mean not to sound defensive, that that really good copy editors are not frustrated writers. They're really good copy editors. But I had my career as a proofreader, as a copy editor. I joined Random House. Years and years go by, but finally I got the bug again. It was a New Year's Eve. I remember we were in Los Angeles and we were having dinner, and it was New Year's Eve, and I got it into my head that I wanted to write again, and I made myself a little New Year's resolution pledge that I was going to write a little something every day to see what it was going to feel like, and I did. But being a practically minded person who works in the publishing industry, it very quickly occurred to me that I should take this effort and this energy and put it into something real. So I talked to the editor-in-chief at Random House, which is to say the editor-in-chief of the company that I work for, and I floated this idea of writing a book about what I do about copy editing, and she took to it quite nicely, and the next thing I knew, I was under contract to write a book. And then even though we all thought I was going to get it done much faster, 6 years later, here we are.
It always kind of takes longer than writers think it's going to take, right?
You would think that as a person who'd been working in publishing for decades, I would know that. But it came as something of a shock to me when the shoe and the pen were on the other foot and hand.
Well, before we get into sort of the nitty-gritty of the book, run our listeners through sort of the process. Once a book is acquired, it's going to be published, an agent has found an editor who wants to be the editor of the book. What happens next? Kind of tell us the process here.
We've gotten off to just exactly the right start. We've got the agent, we've got the author, and we've got the editor. And I always refer to those people as the editors. They're the real editors, and they're the ones who will work with a writer, draft after draft, possibly over the course of a few years, and who knows how many drafts before they are between them satisfied that this book is the way it is supposed to be, and the editors do a lot of stuff, a lot of really long line stuff, narrative arc, characterization, pacing, asking for more of this, less of that. I listen sometimes to the editors that I work with describing to me the what goes on between them and their authors, and it really strikes my brain as a kind of magic. It's not my brain. I don't have that kind of brain. So I very much admire the editors who do that sort of work. But so once the manuscript then is deemed ostensibly finished, that's when the copy editor steps in, and the manuscript is given over to the managing editorial department, which is my other job. I'm the copy chief of the Random House division. I'm also its managing editor, so I have the responsibility of making sure that the book is textually gorgeous, and I also have the responsibility of making sure that it gets published on time. There are people in my department called production editors. That was what I was hired to do when I started at Random House all those years ago. And they hire the copy editor. They hire the copy editor. Eventually, they will also be hiring the proofreaders. But the big first step is the copy editing. And when the manuscript is given to the copy editor, the copy editor really just sort of dives in, and you're looking for everything that might be somewhat amiss. You're checking the punctuation, you're checking the spelling, you're checking to make sure that the author hasn't confused one homophone with another. I mean, that the author meant to say rain, R-E-I-N, but slipped and spelled it R-E-I-G-N. You're looking for grammar. You're looking to make sure that the subjects and the verbs agree. You're also looking for things that might possibly have eluded an author and an editor over the course of the work that they're doing. I mean, for instance, if it's a novel, you want to keep track of the passage of time, make sure that if the writer is talking about 2 days later, 3 days later, that adds up properly, that, you know, that 3 days after Monday is not Saturday, that sort of thing. You're looking to make sure that characters' eyes haven't inadvertently changed from one scene to another, and that's all very sort of, you know, wonky, looking for mistakes kind of stuff. But you're also, if you're a really good copy editor, you're also looking for more subtle things. Authors who may, for instance, we all have a tendency to write everything in threes. I do it all the time myself. You always want to offer up three adjectives or three actions. You might, as a copy editor, want to point out to the author that the use of the threes is maybe getting a little monotonous, paragraph after paragraph. All authors have pet phrases. They have pet words. They have adjectives they particularly like. You want to be mindful of that so that you can point out to them that they've used a particular adjective or phrase, you know, one too many times. All those sorts of things, and ultimately, you are offering up to an author any number of suggestions, because of course it's a conversation, it's a give and take, it's not a dictatorial process. You're offering up to an author any number of suggestions that the author then has the opportunity to review and ponder, and decide to accept some suggestions and possibly reject others. All in the service of making the book, as I always like to say, the best possible version of itself that it can be. Not a copy editor's notion of, oh, I'm going to take this thing and I'm going to turn it into what we consider to be correct prose, because there's no such thing. You're just trying to make the book the best version of itself. And it's a wonderful process. I love copy editing. I know that the authors that I have worked with either more or less intimately over the years, authors love to be copy edited. Nobody's ever going to read you quite as carefully as your copy editor, right down to the nuclear level. And it's a good process. And I think a copy editor can't take a bad manuscript and turn it into a good book, but a copy editor can take a good manuscript and really polish it, and can take a brilliant manuscript and also do what needs to be done to really just make it glow. So that's the process.
So, you know, you mentioned, I think you said something a little while ago about style, but I was curious about that, how a copy editor comes to a project and makes it better, but doesn't impose a voice that isn't there. Or, what if the project is more, I don't know, formal sounding, more formal words? What would the copy editor do with that sort of thing?
Well, when you're copy editing, I always think it's a good idea to read the first 50 or so pages keeping your hands entirely to yourself. No keystrokes, no pencil, no nothing. Just read it. Get a sense of what the author is trying to do. Listen to what the author is doing. Listen to the tone. Listen to the level of formality or the level of informality. And then figure out how to support that. Now, often when the editor editors send the manuscript to be copy edited, they may have some comments about what they might like to see done. You know, a lighter touch, a heavier touch. You know, please be aware of the author has a tendency to be repetitive, and I would appreciate your keeping an eye out for that sort of thing. So it's not as if the copy editor is operating in some sort of vacuum. If you have questions, you ask them, but what you are trying to do is to figure out how the author means to sound on the page and just augment that.
Right, without imposing their own sort of voice or style or what they would do.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I mean, mistakes are mistakes. There are things that you can more or less inarguably call mistakes that need to be fixed. But there's a lot more gray, there's a lot more nuance in prose than I think a lot of people recognize.
You also say in the book, which is just, I think, the best book on grammar that has come along, I think in part because your writing style is so fun, and you hit all these points that I know I've been wondering about, especially with, I think you go in, you have a chapter called Foreign Affairs, where you go into sort of British spellings versus and structure versus, English, what we do here, right? And I think that becomes confusing to people, and I don't think I've ever seen that really covered in any book on grammar. So, so many reasons I love this book. But
well, thank you.
You're welcome. No,
thank
it's
you.
True.
There's going to be a UK edition of the book.
Oh, really?
And they're publishing at the end of May, and I have participated in the process of translating the book from U.S. English into U.K. English. It's quite a trip. It's been fun. We do a gentle translation process from their direction to our direction mm-hmm. all the time. It's quite interesting to me to be a participant in the process in the other direction.
Oh, I'll have to see that. I love that idea. That sounds great. That must have been fun.
Yeah.
So, And I just read, did it happen last week or the week before, there was a copy editors conference and things like, you know, split infinitives are now okay?
Yes, there was a big copy editors conference in Providence, Rhode Island that I had the pleasure of going to. I'd never been to one of these before. And it was huge fun. I mean, it might sound a little strange to think of 900 copy editors wandering around a hotel in Rhode Island, but that was what it was. And there were a number of us who were invited to speak on this subject or that subject. And there are always advances being put up by various voices of editorial authority, you know. And it's like, I have the things that I have to say. The AP. Which is, a very vigorous and important voice, particularly in journalistic style. You know, they have the things that they want to, that they want to advance in the language. So it's all kinds of things, and I found it quite interesting. And it ranges from sort of, bigger abstract conversations about, about inclusion and diversity, to really sort of nitty-gritty stuff like whether or not the hyphen should be retained in the phrase African-American. So everybody, we're all always thinking about language, and we're all always thinking about how it needs to change to reflect, well, just to reflect, you know, the evolution of language, or to reflect that, that society changes, and we as the, you know, as the protectors and guardians, and I hope you can hear the slight sarcastic emoji of that, because I don't view myself as a gatekeeper. I view myself as an assistant to the language. But it's our job to help language do what it needs to do.
Well, and that sort of runs into my next question, which has to do with, it seems that the rules kind of change or are somewhat malleable. Something that maybe was an absolute, you know, 10 years ago is no longer an absolute. Now we can do this. And talk a little bit about that, about rules changing.
Well, I think that language changes in larger and subtler ways. I mean, one of the things that I do up front in my book, and I'm not the first person who's attempted to do this, and I know I'm not going to be the last one who thinks that there's a need to do this, but there are things that we get drummed into our heads when we're kids about what's appropriate and what's inappropriate, what's correct and what's incorrect. And you know, you were told not to begin a sentence with and or but. You were told not to split an infinitive. And it's my job to make the good attempt to disabuse people of these things, to say, you know, you can begin a sentence with and or but. You should begin a sentence with and or but if it suits your purpose to do that. Now, of course, I'll always immediately say, you should think about it. It's not every sentence that is improved by beginning with one of those words. Maybe you don't want to do that. It's not always a strong beginning for a sentence, but you should get it out of your head that it's wrong to do that. As far as the split infinitive rule, which, to explain it to people who might not immediately recognize it, basically when we're talking about a split infinitive, we're talking about, you know, taking a verb form, for instance, to go, and to put between the word to and the word to go an adverb. So, for instance, and most famously, the Star Trek "to boldly go where no man has gone before." Well, it was to boldly go where no man has gone before when the series first went on the air in the 60s. At a certain point, it was nicely updated to boldly go where no one has gone before, which is a nice improvement. But the idea of taking that word boldly and putting it between to and go is what you would refer to as a split infinitive. And for some reason, somebody decided back in the 19th century, when people were making decisions about how language ought to be run, someone decided that it was bad to split an infinitive. So a lot of people march around with the notion in their heads that you're not supposed to split an infinitive, to which my response is, there's nothing wrong with doing it, so just go ahead and do it. So you take those, you know, those sorts of rules. I mean, there are not a lot of things that, there's not a lot of big ticket things that have changed, but there's always little things that are changing. Compound words and whether or not we hyphenate them, that sort of thing. You know, little very nuancy kind of things. And of course, speaking of nuancy, people are always coining words, and it's fun to keep up with them, and to see what people come up with. I mean, I always say that if you're working in the word business and you're not inventing one new word every couple of months, you're not playing the game properly.
Is it possible for you to read to us? Do you have a book right there?
Yeah, hold on a sec.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Benjamin Dreyer. His new book is Dreyer's English, An Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style. Okay.
Yeah. How about the beginning of the rules and non-rules section?
That'd be great.
Okay, maybe, what, four paragraphs?
Yeah, a couple minutes is great.
Okay. Okay, good. All right, this is from chapter two, which is called Rules and Non-Rules. I have nothing against rules. They're indispensable when playing Monopoly or Gin Rummy, and their observance can go a long way toward improving a ride on the subway. The rule of law, big fan. The English language, though, is not so easily ruled and regulated. It developed without codification, sucking up new constructions and vocabulary every time some foreigner set foot on the British Isles, to say nothing of the mischief we Americans have wreaked on it these last few centuries. And it continues to evolve anarchically. It has, to my great dismay, no enforceable laws, much less someone to enforce the laws it doesn't have. Certain prose rules are essentially inarguable, that a sentence's subject and its verb should agree in number, for instance, or that in a not only X but Y construction, the X and the Y must be parallel elements. Why? I suppose because they're firmly entrenched, because no one cares to argue with them, and because they aid us in using our words to their preeminent purpose, to communicate clearly with our readers. Let's call these reasons the four C's, shall we? Convention, consensus, clarity, comprehension. Also, simply because I swear to you, a well-constructed sentence sounds better, literally sounds better. One of the best ways to determine whether your prose is well-constructed is to read it aloud. A sentence that can't readily be voiced is a sentence that likely needs to be rewritten. A good sentence, I find myself saying frequently, is one that the reader can follow from beginning to end, no matter how long it is, without having to double back in confusion because the writer misused or omitted a key piece of punctuation, chose a vague or misleading pronoun, or in some other way engaged in inadvertent misdirection. If you want to puzzle your reader, that's your own business. As much as I like a good rule, I'm an enthusiastic subscriber to the notion of rules are meant to be broken. Once you've learned them, I hasten to add.
That's great. I love it. You've been listening to Benjamin Dreyer read from Dreyer's English. So, you know, in terms of reading aloud, and I probably harangue my students to read their stuff aloud many times before they, you know, say they have a final draft. Say a little bit more about that, because, you know, some would say, well, you know, it should work on the page. It's not how you read it.
I mean, speech and writing are obviously, I mean, English is English, and they're very closely related, but speaking is not the same thing as writing. And if you write simply as a replication of how you speak, you may end up not writing at your best. I mean, there are things that we can do with emphasis when we're speaking. We can be speaking about two people to whom we're applying the pronoun him, and by emphasis and pointing and thising and thatting, we can make it clear to the person who's listening to us which him is which. When you do that on the page, it simply becomes confusing. There are also certain things there. You know, the way we lead to an important point in a sentence, that when we're talking, we may put it in the middle of the sentence. You may find on the page that it's stronger if you take that nice strong bit and you put it at the end of the sentence. I love reading aloud, and I love listening to prose. And I remember one night years ago, gathered with a bunch of friends, one night, and just we all took turns reading stories to one another. And it's that magical thing. I mean, it sort of takes you back to being a kid and being read to. But prose, when it can be read aloud, you can hear how beautifully it works. And I certainly have found that when I'm copy editing, if I'm puzzled by a sentence, if something's bothering me and I can't quite figure out what's the matter with it, if I read it aloud to myself, if I read it aloud, I can often hear what the problem is, and then I can fix it.
And there are, you know, along those lines, there are certain words that that when we're speaking, we'll say them repeatedly, very, actually, you know, just so many words that we'll say but that don't work so well in writing.
Right. I mean, and there are those words that I urge writers up front to go, you know, I say, go a week without writing the word very, without writing rather, without writing of course, without writing actually. And to look at your writing and as I always say, you can go ahead and write them, but once you've written them, try taking them out. They don't add anything. They're sort of filler. I mean, you know, it's a game that I'm always happy to play when you're dealing with, you know, very adjective. It's like, okay, if you're very smart, you're brilliant. If you're very hungry, you're ravenous. If you're very tired, you're exhausted. Just find a strong adjective and let it do the job that it can possibly do. I'd also emphasize that whenever I encounter a phrase that's very adjective, I think that if you take the very out, you will end up with something that in fact sounds stronger. You may think that your use of the very is emphasizing the point you're trying to make. I would suggest that your use of the very is making it sound as if you're pleading your point. If you want to say that somebody's smart, that's a strong thing to say. If you want to say that somebody's very smart, you're pushing it. So let adjectives do what they need to do. And I'm not condemning adverbs. I love adverbs. Just do what you're doing with a purpose. I mean, that sounds like a really easy thing to say, but that's what writing is. It's doing things. It's putting words down on a page with a purpose.
Are there mistakes you see writers making over and over again, common mistakes that come through?
Yeah. I mean, just very sort of nitty-gritty stuff like all the writers in the world who, when they want to write the past tense of the verb to lead, write it out as LEAD rather than LED, and I think that comes from the past tense of the verb to read is read, but they're spelled the same way. So you do the same thing with lead and led. So there's that. So that, you know, that's a tiny sort of little thing. And then there are, you know, then there are correctly or incorrectly using commas to set off. To set off nouns that either are or are not the only version of themselves that a sentence can contain. Let me see if I can explain that sanely. if you're talking about my oldest son, Lawrence, you want a comma between oldest son and Lawrence because the comma says that the thing that is following is the only one of itself that there is. I mean, you can have only one oldest son, which is to say that you could make a reference to my oldest son and not mention Lawrence by name, and the sentence remains absolutely clear. But let's say you have two sons. One is named Lawrence and the other one is named Arthur. If you make a reference to my son Lawrence, it's important that you're not talking about Arthur, so there would be no comma. That's a very sort of technical little point, and I refer to those commas as only commas because that's the easiest way to make them clear. But it's a thing that writers will put the comma in when it doesn't belong, and they will omit it when it does belong, and that's the sort of thing that copy editors are always correcting. I know that sounds very microscopic, but that's what you do.
You know, writers have a hard time with commas. Where do you put the comma? Do you put the comma where you breathe? Do you put the comma where you pause? What if your style is to not use commas? It's very confusing to writers.
It can be confusing. It is confusing. And the one thing that I will say about commas and about punctuation generally is that I have certainly noticed in the nearly 30 years that I've been, you know, working at this, that people use less punctuation people use less punctuation now than they did when I got started. And of course, if you want to go back to the 19th century and you want to look at writers like, you know, Dickens or Henry James, it's an extravaganza of commas and punctuation. So it begins to sort of turn down bit by bit. But there are some commas that I would deem to be necessary, and there are some commas that I would deem to be a matter of taste and a matter of preference. And, you know, your job as a copy editor is sort of help the writer sort that out.
What about the series comma?
Of all the punctuation in the world, of all the commas in the world, I am a hard and fast champion of the series comma, or the serial comma, or the Oxford comma, as people call it, which is the comma that if you're giving a list, if you're talking about going to the store and you bought apples, bananas, and cherries, it's the comma that you would put after bananas and before and cherries. Now, in book publishing, not to speak in absolutes, but in book publishing, just about everybody uses the series comma. In journalism, most people are trained not to use it. So we get to sit in our separate camps and make fun of one another. I love the series comma, as I like to say. Many sentences can be improved by the use of the series comma, and no sentence has ever been harmed by one. And I would add only that authors who say, "Oh, I will just use the series comma when it's important," have to me the confounding habit of using it when it's not helping clarity, and then not using it when it's desperately needed. As a copy editor, I have a sense of neatness and consistency that I find valuable and makes me feel secure. So I just think if you want to use the series comma, just use it every single time. You know, just put it in there and just be done with it. Don't if you have time to think about the placement of a series comma over and over again, you have a lot more time than I have. So I say just set the thing and be done with it.
I don't think the New Yorker uses it. Kind of makes me crazy when I see that it's not there.
It's funny. I can't right now. There are so many things. There are so many distinctive things that the New Yorker does, but I can't recall off the top of my head whether they use the series comma. I certainly know the New York Times doesn't, and I had the pleasure maybe 2 months ago of writing an op-ed piece for the Washington Post, which I was on the phone with the editor, and he said, "You know, we're going to be taking out all those series commas." And I was thinking, oh boy. And of course I knew they were going to do that. I mean, I know what newspaper style is. And of course, as I reminded myself, if I weren't so relentlessly in the habit of writing things in threes, I wouldn't be having this conversation. I can speak in non-series comma too, and my feelings weren't too hurt.
What about comma splices?
Comma splices, which we would say that's the comma you would use between two freestanding independent sentences that might either be better separated into two sentences with a period between them, or might be joined with a semicolon. So if you're using a comma where you might better use a semicolon, we would call that's a comma splice. In nonfiction, in formal nonfiction, I would steer writers away from it. In copy editing fiction, if the narrative voice is racing, if it's propulsive, I think that I could understand in the copy edit why the writer is using that comma instead of using a semicolon, and encourage that, you know, and be happy about that. I have worked with writers who will use semicolons when they want to use semicolons, and they'll use the comma splice when they want to use the comma splice, and I can hear the difference. So unless I think there's clearly an issue of confusion that is not intentional, I'll support that comma splice.
You mentioned the semicolon, and I know there are grammarians who hate the semicolon, but you like it. So talk about the semicolon.
I love it, and I think it's a wonderful piece of punctuation. It holds together sentences that, yes, they can exist as separate sentences, but you want to hold them a little closer to each other. My favorite writer is Shirley Jackson, who most people know these days as the author of the short story The Lottery, which I think by law we were all required to read in high school. And she's also the author of the novel The Haunting of Hill House, which many people know from the Netflix series. I call her Shirley because I had the opportunity to copy edit her a few years ago, even though she's been dead for 50 years. So I like to be on a first name basis with my writers. She loves the semicolon. She loved the semicolon, and she used it, and she wielded it quite beautifully. I always like to cite the first paragraph of The Haunting of Hill House, which has, if I recall correctly, three semicolons in it. And she uses them to bind her thoughts together, and in fact, it helps create this kind of claustrophobic sense that I think is exactly what she's going for and exactly appropriate. And they work. There are a number of writers and other people who have made somewhat silly public statements about semicolons that, you know, yeah, you use a semicolon so you can prove to people that you went to college. I mean, I think that's silly. I think that to condemn a helpful, useful, eloquent piece of punctuation because you think it's pretentious or because you don't know how to use it, I can't support that. I love a good semicolon.
I love what you say in this book about the word curate, because this is a word that has been driving me crazy the way it's being used these days. Can you talk about that and words, you know, your pet peeves and different things
Sure.
that you talk about in the book?
I mean, there are words that find their way into the language. There are words that come into the language via business. There are words that come into the language via human resources people, and I love my human resources colleagues, but they do like to coin terms. There are words that come into the language via advertising, and sometimes I think that people want to invent new words or repurpose old words so that they can seem innovative. And really, you're just, more often than not, or frequently, you're just dressing up your somewhat shop-worn ideas with fancy new terms so that you can sound like you're a thought leader. Specifically, the word curate is a wonderful thing to describe what people do who work in museums. I think that if you have this crashing need to use the verb curate to describe your having put together a really good list of songs to play at the gym, I think that you are using the word in a way that's it's just not helping. And one of the pitfalls of it is that people who like to grab onto these newfangled uses, they may be causing a lot of eye rolling in other quarters, and not necessarily just from people who are old, like I am, but people who just find that sort of thing silly. So if you want to use what I just sort of tend to think of as the very au courant buzz terms, you might end up sounding silly, and maybe you don't want to sound silly. I mean, I don't need to see the word artisanal again for a long time. I'll be perfectly happy. I mean, handmade is a perfectly nice way to phrase something, and does artisanal really bring something to the conversation? On the other hand, people have been complaining about the use of the verb impact, where you might simply say affect, for decades. And it's not going away, and it's never going to go away. I don't have to like it. I don't have to use it. And I might attempt to persuade an author against it, but some things just get established, and they do become at a certain point inarguable. But also, I'm always tickled when a word wanders into view that really does bring something to the table. I mean, selfie. Selfie is a great word. Selfie mm-hmm. describes something that there is no other word for. Regift is wonderful. It says something, and it has some style, and it does a thing. So when I see terms like that, I think, yeah, come on in, join the party.
What about using they when you're talking about when you're in, you know, she went to the, you know, the store, and I don't know, I'm not coming up with a good sentence, but you know, they is used for singular.
Yeah. Right. I mean, all right. So here I am in real life, and I'm talking to one of my production editors, and I will say something like, "Yeah, okay. When the copy editor is done with the job, will you make sure that they send it back right away?"
Uh-huh.
We all naturally speak in the singular they. We don't naturally say, when the copy editor's done, will you ask he or she to send it back right away? We just, you know, the singular they is how we speak. And on the subject, which can be a very contentious subject, so I always try to navigate it carefully. The singular they has been in use in the English language for centuries. That is an inarguable fact. I would also, however, assert that for many people, and if you look at all kinds of published writing of the 20th century, from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, you will not be running into the singular they on a regular basis. The editorial taste of those decades was not to use it. So, okay, so that's point one, that's point two. But the thing is this, when I started copy editing in the 90s, it was still considered a very normal thing to, in a sentence, when you wanted to refer to a person, you know, an indefinite, non-specified person whose gender was not being discussed at the moment, which is to say you were making a reference to a student. Yes, a student should be able to do whatever he wants. So the default use of the pronoun he to refer to any sort of human being comes out of a mindset that basically says, well, yeah, because, of course, a normal human being is a he. Well, as we well know, a normal human being is not a he. In fact, only half, at most half, have the pronoun he attached. So what has happened is that in these last few decades, there are any number of ways to write around using he in that way. And of course, one of the easiest ways to do it is, if you're talking about a student, well, then just pluralize it, and then you can say, you know, students should be able to study whatever they want. But to make a very long story short, the singular they is not something that is going to happen. The singular they is not the wave of the future. The singular they is the wave of the present, and people are going to use it, and people are going to write it, and you can either keep up with that or you can fight about it. And I think that fighting about it is bad form. And we came to the conclusion, meeting me and my staff, the production editors that I work with here, that we finally decided to make it a policy that if you receive a manuscript and it's going to copy editing, and the writer has clearly made a conscious decision to use the singular they, you don't fight it. You let the writer do what the writer is doing. It's not something to be squabbled over anymore. The only thing really I would add to this conversation is that the use of the pronoun they by people for whom that's their pronoun, that's a different issue, and the thing that I have learned, and I have to say it took personal interaction between me and a colleague whose pronoun is they before it finally hit home with me, before it went from being a copy editorial issue to being a personal issue. And I think that you shouldn't necessarily have to, you know, have a personal one-on-one situation to learn how to evolve, but we're human beings and we're frail and we can be a little narrow-minded and you do the best you can. But in having a relationship with this colleague where I found myself for months, a couple of months, doing everything that I could to avoid referring to my colleague by any sort of pronoun at all until I finally realized how idiotic I was being about the whole thing. And then, you know, the word they just popped out of my mouth when I was talking about them. And I thought, oh, good. Well, that's the end of that, finally. Welcome to the 21st century. copy editing taste and what you think is appropriate in good English should be violently outweighed by your respect for other human beings. So it didn't take me that long, and I wish it had taken me 1 second, but, you know, it got done.
What about the exclamation point?
You know, we all use a lot of exclamation points when we're texting and when we're on social media. I know that I do it. I mean, I can't say thank you anymore without an exclamation point, because if you don't use an exclamation point, you might sound as if you don't really mean it. And fine, so I'm used to that, and I do it all the time, and you just do it. But when we're talking about prose that, you know, you intend to see published, and not just at Twitter or on Facebook or a text to your husband, I am a firm believer, not, of course, in eliminating the exclamation point, because then I would be just as bad as the people who complain about semicolons, but dial it down a little bit. You know, certainly if a character is shrieking because her hair is on fire, I will not begrudge her an exclamation point. But, you know, maybe, okay, you know, a half dozen, eight, nine, ten over the course of an entire book, maybe that's enough exclamation points. There are so many other ways to convey urgency. Yes. Or excitement that don't require, you know, that banging punctuation mark. Of course, there are other people who are much stricter than I about that. I mean, you know, there are people who will say, no, I think maybe a dozen exclamation points over the course of a career is appropriate. I'm not so pure.
Restrictive clauses. You do love them, and I think they're confusing to people. Can you talk a little bit? We have a few minutes left. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about restrictive clauses.
I think it's just a matter of, I mean, I write great big piled up sentences with lots of things going on in them, and in the passage that I was reading earlier about, you know, how a sentence, no matter how long, should be comprehensible from beginning to end, I like to think that I can write a very long sentence with, you know, all sorts of restrictive clauses and parentheticals and all kinds of things, you know, going back and forth, and it can be clear. I'm happy to report that in the editing and the copy editing of my manuscript, I had editorial people say to me, not as clear as you think it is. And that's when you start looking at what you're doing and thinking, well, I suppose that I could simplify that. I suppose that I don't need to keep the subject of the sentence a full 35 words away from the verb of the sentence. And then just sort of, you know, try to be a little less fancy. I mean, I'm a fancy writer. I like all my little sort of curly cues. But simplicity is nice, too. How's that?
I like that. I like that.
Okay, good.
I think an article I read, I think either in the New York or the New York Times, the writer said that restrictive clauses for you are like Legos. It was an interesting way to put it, you know? I like that.
Yeah.
And then we have a couple of minutes still. Attributions, you know, other than said or say.
I mean, some writers will walk away from he said, she said, he said, she said, because they think that they're becoming boring in doing that. I think that those simple dialogue attributions, they're essentially invisible. Readers don't notice that they're there. They don't notice that they're not there. So to go on varying them is not as necessary as some writers seem to think. Now, I don't mind a, you know, he shrieked, she shouted, that sort of thing. I do perhaps, you know, walk away from, you know, he importuned ruefully. A little of that goes a terribly long way. But, you know, I mean, the funny thing is, and I always like to reach for this because it's kind of shocking when you look at it all over again. I mean, pick up The Great Gatsby and start looking at the dialogue tags. He's very fancy with his dialogue attributions. And somehow, unless you're me and you're laser focused on them, you don't notice that he's doing it. But again, simpler is nice when simpler is nice, and fancier is nice when fancier is nice. I mean, I think the thing is, I'm trying not to sound as if I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. What I'm really trying to say is, think about what you're doing, mm-hmm. write effectively, enjoy what you're writing, and then you know, ask somebody to help you make sure that it's the best that it can be. I'm making a sort of a great big embracing gesture sitting here in my office right now with my arms. I think that's what language is. It's about embracing language as much as possible, not you know, paring it down and shaving it away until it's just absolutely simple and bleak and apocalyptic. it's for fun, so you use it for fun.
Well, on that note, thank you so very much. This has been a great hour with you and your book and your humor. So thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me. That was one of the fastest hours of chatting I've had in a long time.
Oh, my pleasure. That was Benjamin Dreyer. His wonderful book is Dreyer's English, An Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style. And it's just written with the voice you just heard. It's such a fun read. And, you know, it's hard to say that about grammar, isn't it? In any case, that's all the time we have today. We'll be back next week. So come back. You can also subscribe to Writers on Writing on iTunes. Go there. Look for Writers on Writing in the podcast category. Subscribe. And when we podcast this show, it will land in your podcast file on your phone, on your computer, wherever it is that you keep it. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I will see you next time.